to Refilwe Mpakanyane. 1702.
Going on 7:36 on the Sunday, the 13th of November. We're talking sustainability as we do at this time of the program on Weekend Breakfast. And we're focusing on the COP27 Climate Summit. The fact, of course, is that they've reached the halfway point warming limits, emissions compensation being in the spotlight. What am I talking about? I'm talking about the UN climate talks in Egypt taking place at Sharm el-Sheikh. It's a two-week-long meeting. Right throughout the week, we've been hearing news of world leaders descending on Sharm el-Sheikh and talking about, you know, what or trying to reach some kind of consensus about around the way forward. If we are going to mitigate the effects of climate change and curb carbon emissions and take responsibility really for, I guess, a reckless posture that we've assumed all these years. But most importantly, from an African perspective, we're asking a question around what African leaders ought to be focused on and intentional about as they interact with leaders from the global north at these negotiations or these discussions at Sharm el-Sheikh. So African researchers are marshalling, putting together the arguments for COP27 to assert that what Africa can do to tackle climate change has to be informed by its own conditions, by specific conditions for which solutions tailored for Europe, Asia or America will not work. And we're going to talk about and unpack the research that African researchers are relying on to, you know, essentially mold the kinds of conversations and I'll say demands as well that ought to be made at Sharm el-Sheikh. To help us have this conversation and asking or posing or unpacking what Africa's position for COP27 ought to be is Dr. Laura Pereira. Dr. Laura Pereira is an interdisciplinary sustainability scientist as well as senior researcher from Oppenheimer Generations Research. Dr. Pereira, thank you so much for your time and welcome to Weekend Breakfast.
Hi, good morning. Good to be with you.
Of course, it ought to be Oppenheimer Generations Research and Conservation. I left that little bit off. So COP27 is the United Nations Climate Change Conference, which we abbreviate to that. The 27th of its kind. How important is this installment of these climate change of this climate change conference? It's been many, many years of talking. How much action?
Well, I mean, that's really, really the crux of the issue. I mean, I think it's important to contextualize these intergovernmental discussions. You know, you need action at multiple different levels.
Yes.
So obviously what really happens on the ground within local communities, in cities, even at the national level is extremely important. But it's also critical to have these sort of international discussions where governments actually have to come around and recognize that we have this really big challenge that we need to work around addressing together. And that's where these negotiations become important. You know, we had the Kyoto Protocol that was discussed already in 1997. Mm-hmm. That's now subsequently been replaced by the Paris Agreement in 2015. And now it's really just about ironing out some of the specificities and looking at, you know, commitments that were made previously to say, okay, and be around funding. We said that this is an important area. Where is the funding coming from? Adding new aspects to the discussions, you know, as science becomes clearer in some areas, it's necessary to negotiate things. So, for example, in Glasgow last year, the ocean was included as a really important component of the discussions, looking at blue carbon, how much it actually sequesters carbon for us. And this year is, you know, it's back on the African continent, so it's been dubbed again as an African COP. You know, it's not the only one we've had. We had one in Durban a couple of years ago. There's been Morocco, Marrakesh. But yeah, it's really important to have it hosted in multiple different places so that there can be a different flavor. So
yeah.
So that's really the importance of the discussions that we're having now.
So 2022 is the Africa COP taking place, as you say, on African soil after many, many years. it's obviously viewed as an opportunity, a valuable opportunity to focus global attention on Africa's vulnerability to climate change. And, you know, in terms of the context that you're talking about, we're also having this COP27 conference in the context of understanding that despite the fact that we have not been as the global south and low income and middle income countries, we haven't been, as it were, the main sort of perpetrators of carbon emissions, but we bear heavily the brunt thereof. So when we talk climate justice, what are we talking about, and how should African countries come to COP27 and any discussions regarding pledges that were made at Glasgow last year, amounts of what, $100 billion for enabling us to, you know, enact a just transition or to green energy, etc.?
So I think there are multiple aspects to climate justice. I think, you know, what you mentioned now is the critical aspect. You know, Africa is responsible for less than 4% of global emissions, and yet we're going to be facing the biggest brunt of the impacts of climate change. South Africa is different in that instance, in that we are also actually one of the biggest emitters because of our coal-based energy system. So we're slightly different in that instance. And so looking at the just transition of how we can build a cleaner, more sustainable, healthier energy system. You know, that's where we're looking at the just transition. We're a lot of funding to actually say, okay, let's move into renewables, but we also need to recognize jobs, right? So people also need to be reskilled in the renewable energy sector. So, you know, that's where a lot of the funding needs to come from. So that's an important component, but that tends to be a little bit more bilateral. It, you know, doesn't come from the central pot. I think from an African sort of outside of South Africa perspective, you know, definitely looking at development pathways that are decarbonized, right? So how can we still actually think about meeting people's needs, but not going through the same pathway that the industrialized nations did, sort of relying on fossil fuels? And that's going to require, I think, both funding, but also a lot of innovation ourselves to actually think through where is it that we want to go. And I think, you know, quite often we're not really having that conversation of we could be in a much better place if we think about much more strategic development pathways. So I think that's an important component.
Yeah.
Adaptation is also critical for the continent. So we're not just looking at mitigation of carbon emissions, which is critical in the South African context, but adapting across the continent is going to be fundamental. Adapting how we grow our food, adapting our infrastructure, whether it's buildings. We saw what the floods in Cape did in earlier this year. You know,
absolutely.
Those are the kinds of events that we're going to be facing more of. I mean, climate change is already happening, right? It's not sort of something in the near future. It's being around us now. So adaptation funding, I think, is a critical aspect. And then again, there's further discussions on, I guess you could call it reparations, right? Looking at payments for loss and damage that's going to be incurred. And I think that is really the discussion that's happening at the moment. And obviously, rich countries are not wanting to enter into that discussion because they know that it could just become huge. Right, as we go forward, and they're not sort of really willing to put money forward because, you know, it could just continue to escalate, because that's exactly what climate change is going to do. So those are some of the awkward discussions and the important discussions that are underway at the moment.
So, of course, discussions of this nature, as much as we like to imagine that all these world leaders are at this conference and driven by altruistic motives, we know that's not the case. So what do we leverage as a continent that hopefully is synchronized in their negotiations and in their movement? What do we leverage in order to force rich countries to have that discussion and come to the party in as much good faith as possible around loss and damage? Because you've spoken about You know, we can point to the climate events and weather events in Mozambique, for instance. We can look at what happened, the flooding that took place in Pakistan, which is absolutely horrific. A third of that country underwater just recently. How do we then make sure that rich countries do come to the table and negotiate in good faith when it comes to loss and damage, as you say, a discussion that they've not wanted to have regarding their part in where we find ourselves in this climate change scenario?
Yeah, crikey. I mean, if I had the answer to that, I think we wouldn't necessarily have
peace. Did I just ask you how you're going to achieve world peace?
Pretty much. How are we going to save the planet? I mean, I think there are aspects that we could emphasize, you know, if we come together as an African continent, as the global south. You know, again, we all have different interests within that. So you see, you know, South Africa sits in this interesting position of both being G77, but also African, but also the BRICS. And I think we wear different hats, you know, so that's the other thing. We're not, it's kind of not a singular aspect in any of these discussions that, that countries are taking over. I think that one of the critical aspects that we do need to just recognize and bring to the table is this idea of nature-based solutions that has been sort of touted through the discussions. And this also links to another COP that we're going to be discussing around the Convention on Biological Diversity in December in Montreal later in the year. So there a lot of these discussions, climate tends to take the leading discussions in the media, but I would argue that the biodiversity COP is just as important for us as a continent and making sure that the connections between those are actually really clear.
I was going to ask you to just flesh that out. Why is it important to thread that needle and make a connection? Of course, what does that mean for the future of the continent and, I guess, the globe?
Sure, for sure. So, it comes back to this idea of nature-based solutions. I think we prefer to talk about ecological approaches. So back to discussing the development pathways that I was mentioning, you know, how can we meet needs? How can we sort of create livelihoods whilst not having sort of dire environmental impacts? This idea of actually ecological approaches is a really important one. Mm-hmm. I think that we need to look for funding to actually enable. So we've got a lot of commitments that are going to be coming up out of the, hopefully, the post-2020 Global Biodiversity Framework happening in December around sort of biodiversity conservation, preservation, but also looking at equitable access and benefit sharing of biodiversity. So I think that's a critical one, making sure that, you know, where we are actually able to maintain our biodiversity, that people around there do actually benefit from that, that it doesn't kind of just get exported out to benefit countries elsewhere, right? So that flow of resources, that's an important component. And I think that's where the link with the climate discussion is critical, because at the moment, this idea of, in some framings, not in all framings, this idea of nature-based solutions is basically, can we use nature in the South, nature in Africa, to be a solution to the fact that a lot of the Western countries are continuing to emit carbon, right? So planting trees is a very good example of this, right? So trees sequester carbon, and so we can actually draw down some of the emissions that are being emitted elsewhere by planting trees in some landscapes. The thing is, African environments, so yes, we have the Congo Basin with the rainforest there, super critically important to actually make sure that we don't continue to deforest in that area. But that's actually largely to do with mining. And as we also know, sort of mining tends to also leave, and the benefits thereof tend to leave our shores before the benefits actually accrue to the people around there. So I think we need to be thinking through what that looks like. But, you know, where our biodiversity and where our livelihoods are sort of actually very strongly based across the continent are in our savannas, right? And our grasslands. And, you know, so the idea of going plant more trees in a savanna is kind of, well, now you're changing the fact that this is a savanna, which is a mixed grassland system. And, you know, this is where we have pastoralists, where we have a lot of our grazing and our rangelands, you know, where we have a lot of our biodiversity and tourism potential. You know, there's so much cultural attachment to these places that we need to also recognize that you know, these are important environments. And at the moment, as far as I'm aware, the definition of a savanna, they're still following the FAO definition, which was created for another purpose in the early 2000s, which is that a savanna is a degraded forest. You know, so if it's degraded, then clearly it needs to be restored into something else. And so it's a lot easier for these kinds of interventions to be made. And I think that this is where, you know, the Convention on Biological Diversity and other kind of sustainable development pathways really need to come to the fore. And African negotiators need to recognize that, you know, we can't just let these interventions around tree planting to sort of benefit emitters elsewhere take over our natural landscapes and our cultural heritage, because I think that's going to be irreversible, right? So we need to be very cautious, and I think that's where African science can be really important in actually providing the evidence as to sort of why these sorts of mechanisms don't work, but what kind of mechanisms may actually benefit.
Evidence-based conversations and solutions, ones that we need to enter into in a circumspect manner. Very quickly, Dr. Pereira, as I let you go, for a layperson such as myself who is trying to understand what is, as you've acknowledged, a rather complex discussion and situation, how do we, or where should we go to, educate ourselves better and have a sort of working definition or ability to have these conversations and these discussions? Because we all need to be, whether or not we ever make it as individuals to Sharm el-Sheikh, we need to understand these things because it's obviously pertinent to our lives, our futures.
100%. And I think in particularly, so many of us invest our money, and where we invest our money, it's not just governments that are sitting in Sharm el-Sheikh, it's also businesses, investment, finance, where I think we can be more strategic in where we allocate that, even as individuals and our pension funds. So, so we all do have a role to play in sort of how this global discourse plays out.
Yeah.
So there's really useful information. Carbon Brief does some interesting sort of updates on sort of the state of carbon globally quite free, sort of every couple of months. There are also just journalists and really good people that are reporting back, and I can maybe sort of give you a list of those. Us at WITS are also some of the Global Change Institute at WITS University, and we've just been funded a program called Future Ecosystems for Africa by Oppenheimer Generations Research and Conservation, and we are trying to also just be a platform where people can go for sort of reports, bite-sized information, and, you know, just getting a better sense of what are we actually doing from an African perspective.
Lovely. We're going to have to leave it right there. But Dr. Laura Pereira is an interdisciplinary sustainability scientist and senior researcher from the Oppenheimer Generations Research and Conservation Program. Thank you so much for your time this morning. We really appreciate that. We'll get that list of journalists doing important work and reporting back on climate change on the continent. And we'll post it up on my Twitter account @Mpakanyane. But those resources, Carbon Brief is one of them that she mentioned.